U.S. and Soviet IRBMs in Europe, while allowing Britain and France to maintain their arsenals, freeze short-range missiles, stop nuclear testing, allow on-site inspections as the Americans demanded, and limit SDI testing to labs for the next 10 years. Reagan initially failed to grasp the significance of what Gorbachev had proposed, or the fact that he was acceding to long-standing U.S. demands, leaving the Soviet leader frustrated by his response. During the break, Reagan huddled with his advisors back at the U.S. Embassy. Paul Nitze observed that the Soviet proposal was the best we have received in 25 years. The debate continued at the following session. Gorbachev pushed Reagan to seize this extraordinary opportunity. Reagan gave on some points, but held tight to his vision of SDI. Gorbachev countered that he wouldn't be able to convince his people and his allies to make such dramatic reductions in strategic weapons if Reagan insisted on destroying the ABM treaty. Reagan offered to share SDI with the Soviets at some date in the future when it was ready. One of Reagan's advisors, Jack Matlock, recalled, Gorbachev finally exploded. "Excuse me, Mr. President," he said, his voice rising, "but I cannot take your idea of sharing SDI seriously. You are not willing to share with us your oil well equipment, digitally guided machine tools, or even milking machines. Sharing SDI would provoke a second American Revolution. Let's be realistic and pragmatic." Expert negotiating teams met through the night, hammering out an agreement both sides could live with. Nitze led the U.S. team. Marshal Sergei Akromeyev led the Soviet team. Kenneth Edelman, Associate Director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, proclaimed, "Defining strategic systems, excluding bomber weapons, and closing on limits is one amazing night's work. Indisputably more progress than we achieved in thousands of hours and hundreds of meetings over the previous 5 years." But when they met the next morning, negotiations again ran aground. As Gorbachev summarized them, they agreed on reducing strategic weapons and on intermediate-range nuclear weapons, but failed on the comprehensive nuclear test ban and on the ABM treaty. "Let's go home," the despondent Gorbachev said. "We've accomplished nothing." After discussing other matters, Gorbachev made one last-ditch effort, proposing that Schultz and Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze meet over lunch to see if they could resolve the differences. Over lunch, the Soviet foreign minister, objecting to the fact that the Soviets had thus far made all the concessions, pressed the United States for compromise on SDI. The United States came up with a formulation that would achieve the intended gains while allowing it to keep SDI. At the afternoon session, Gorbachev countered with a proposal that the ABM treaty remain in effect for 10 years, with neither party having the right of withdrawal or the right to test any components of an ABM system outside laboratories, and a 50% reduction in strategic offensive weapons in 5 years, with the remainder to be eliminated in the next 5 years. After further wrangling over the details, each leader met with his close advisors. Reagan asked Pearl, the most conservative member of his team, whether the United States could proceed with its SDI research under the constraints placed by the Soviets. Pearl, who feared that a sweeping arms control deal would strengthen the Soviet economy and society, replied, "Mr. President, we cannot conduct the research under the terms he's proposing. It will effectively kill SDI." Reagan then solicited opinions from Schultz and Nitze, both of whom disagreed with Pearl and urged Reagan to accept Gorbachev's wording. When they returned, Gorbachev realized that Reagan had changed the language from eliminating all strategic weapons to eliminating only all offensive ballistic missiles, the area in which the Soviets were strongest. Gorbachev objected. Reagan finally relented and asked, "Do we have in mind that by the end of the 2 5-year periods, all nuclear explosive devices would be eliminated, including bombs, battlefield systems, cruise missiles, submarine weapons, intermediate-range systems, and so on?" Gorbachev agreed. "We can say that. List all those weapons." Schultz responded, "Then let's do it." Gorbachev said he was ready to sign the agreement to eliminate nuclear weapons if Reagan restricted SDI testing to the laboratory. Reagan balked Heating Pearl's advice and insisted on the right to conduct atmospheric tests. They had reached an impasse. Gorbachev made one last appeal. If we sign a package containing major concessions by the Soviet Union regarding fundamental problems, you will become, without exaggeration, a great president. You are now literally two steps from that. If not, then let's part at this point and forget about Reykjavik. But there won't be another opportunity like this. At any rate, I know I won't have one. I firmly believe that we could come to an agreement. Otherwise, I would not have raised the question of an immediate meeting with you. Otherwise, I would not have come here in the name of the Soviet leadership with a solid store of serious compromising proposals. I hope they would meet with understanding and support from your side, that we could resolve all issues. If this does happen, if we manage to achieve deep reductions and the destruction of nuclear arms, all of your critics will not dare open their mouths. They would then be going against the opinions of the overwhelming majority of people in the world who would welcome our success. If, on the other hand, we are not able to come to an agreement, it will obviously become the job of another generation of leaders. You and I have no more time. The American side has essentially not made any concessions, not a single major step to meet us halfway. It's hard to do business on that basis. Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze then interjected, very emotionally, that future generations, reading the minutes of meetings and seeing how close the participants had come to eliminating nuclear weapons, would never forgive them if they didn't come to an agreement. Reagan said that adding the word laboratory would cause him great political damage at home. Gorbachev said that if he allowed the United States to take the arms race to space and deploy SDI after 10 years, he would be viewed as foolish and irresponsible. Each asked the other to bend. Neither would. The meeting ended. The United States and the Soviet Union had come within a hair's breadth, one word, of eliminating nuclear weapons. But the scourge of nuclear weaponry would continue to haunt the world. Reagan, egged on by arch neocon Pearl, sacrificed the hopes of humanity for an illusion. A Star Wars fantasy that, as Richard Rhodes wrote, represented little more than a specious concern for testing outside the laboratory systems that had hardly yet even entered the laboratory in 1986. Reagan and Gorbachev left the building. Gorbachev described the scene. It was already dusk. The mood was downcast. Reagan reproached me. You planned from the beginning to come here and put me in this position. No, Mr. President, I replied. I am prepared to go back inside right now and sign the document concerning the issues we already agreed upon. If you will refrain from plans to militarize space. I'm extremely sorry, Reagan answered. Gorbachev expressed optimism in public, highlighting how much progress the two sides had made. For the first time we looked beyond the horizon, he declared, but in private he expressed profound disappointment at U.S. obstinacy. He explained to the Politburo that he was dealing not only with the class enemy, the capitalist United States, but with President Reagan, who exhibited extreme primitivism, a caveman outlook, and intellectual impotence. That, however, was not the main impediment. The first problem, he averred, was tactical. The United States had miscalculated the extent of the Soviet Union's internal difficulties, and therefore assumed that Gorbachev would be most desperate to reach an agreement, even on U.S. terms. The second was strategic. The United States believed it might exhaust us economically via the arms race, create obstacles for Gorbachev and for the entire Soviet leadership, undermine its plans for resolving economic and social problems, and thereby provoke popular discontent. The U.S. leaders, he said, hoped this would rupture Soviet relations with Third World nations and, with the help of SDI, achieve military superiority. In concluding his remarks, Gorbachev expressed his bitterness toward the U.S. negotiators. Representatives of American administration are people without conscience, with no morale. Their line is the one of pressure, deceit, or greedy mercantilism. Both sides hoped to revive the talks, but before that could happen, scandal rocked the Reagan-Bush administration. On October 5, 1986, the Sandinistas downed a plane manned by three Americans carrying supplies to Nicaragua's Contras. The only survivor admitted to working for the CIA. Additional information slowly leaked out as hearings of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the Tower Commission lifted the veil from an administration up to its eyeballs in illegality, corruption, blundering, and subterfuge, involving American hostages in Lebanon, arms sales to Iran, unsuccessful efforts to halt the torture and prevent the murder of the CIA station chief in Beirut, ill-fated attempts to cultivate non-existent moderates in Tehran, support for Iraq in its war with Iran, and collaboration with a rogues gallery of unsavory characters, including Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega, as it funneled war materiel to the Contras in Nicaragua, in flagrant violation of the 1982 Boland Amendment, which outlawed U.S. financial aid to efforts to defeat the ruling Sandinistas. The principal operatives in the affair, aside from Reagan and Bush, were CIA Director Casey, National Security Advisor McFarlane, and Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, a decorated Vietnam veteran who had suffered an apparent nervous breakdown upon returning from Vietnam and spent 22 days in Bethesda Naval Hospital. North, who was assigned to the NSC in 1981, was a gung-ho Marine with a taste for hyperbole and a touch of megalomania, who had, after his return from Vietnam and hospitalization, become a fundamentalist Christian. North ran much of the operation on a day-to-day basis, putting together an unsavory network of right-wing fundraisers, covert operatives, and conniving arms dealers to carry it out. The CIA attempted to circumvent the congressional constraints upon its actions, but did not do a very good job of hiding its involvement. It made the mistake of bringing in retired Special Forces veterans who had served in Vietnam. In one embarrassing episode, they convinced the agency to translate into Spanish an old comic book instructing Vietnamese peasants on ways to take over a village by murdering the mayor, chief of police, and militia. The CIA distributed a Spanish-language version of this, Freedom Fighter's Manual, to the Contras. Some ended up in the hands of opponents of the U.S. wars in Central America who made them public. Americans also learned that the CIA had mined Nicaraguan harbors, which provoked conservative icon Barry Goldwater to scold Casey. "I am pissed off," he wrote. "This is an act violating international law. It is an act of war." Congress reacted in October 1984 by strengthening the Boland Amendment and cutting off all aid to the Contras. In order to tie Casey's hands, Congress explicitly prohibited any intelligence agency from soliciting funds from any nation, group, organization, movement, or individual. Chief of Staff James Baker feared that administration crazies would nonetheless solicit funds from other countries, which Casey, McFarlane, and North proceeded to do. Saudi Arabia provided the lion's share, but other nations, including South Africa, Israel, and Taiwan, pledged millions of dollars more. Schultz had warned Reagan that approving further assistance would constitute an impeachable offense, but Casey, Bush, and Reagan all poo-pooed that notion. Reagan instructed his top aides to do what they could. He told National Security Advisor McFarlane, "I want you to do whatever you have to do to help these people keep body and soul together." McFarlane soon saw a way to carry that out. In summer 1985, he met with David Kimchi, Director General of the Israel Foreign Ministry. Kimchi convinced him that he was working with Iranian moderates who were poised to take power when the elderly Ayatollah Khomeini passed from the scene. He suggested that in return for arms, the Iranians could help secure the release of U.S. hostages being held in Lebanon by Hezbollah, a pro-Iranian Shiite group. Included among the hostages was CIA Beirut Station Chief William Francis Buckley, who, unknown to the Americans, had been tortured to death in June. In mid-1985, Reagan, despite his public opposition to negotiating with hostage takers, authorized Israel to transfer TOW anti-tank missiles to Iran. Israel continued to serve as the go-between in weapon sales for 14 months. During that time, Iran released some American hostages, but seized more, so that it always had a steady supply to barter. Israel had also been secretly sending its own weapons to the Ayatollah's regime. The notion of dealing with Iranian moderates had gained currency among top administration officials, who began to think about the shape of a post-Khomeini Iran. In June 1985, the CIA produced a national intelligence estimate on Iran titled Iran, Prospects for a Near-Term Instability, which suggested that conditions inside Iran were unstable and Khomeini's days might be numbered. The NSC picked up on this theme in a national security directive, suggesting that Iranian moderates might be inclined toward the United States. Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger wrote on his copy of the report, "This is almost too absurd for comment. It's based on the assumption there's about to be a major change in Iran and that we can deal with that rationally. It's like inviting Gaddafi over for a cozy lunch." The Iranians demanded and the United States sent Hawk anti-aircraft missiles and other weapons. In 1986, the Iranians requested and received battlefield intelligence to assist them in their war with Iraq. They paid exorbitantly for the assistance. Flush with money from the Iranian arms sales and from the Saudis, the CIA expanded its military support for the Contras, with the anti-Castro Cubans Felix Rodriguez and Luis Posada Carriles playing a major part. Rodriguez was a close associate of Vice President Bush's national security advisor, Donald Gregg, a former CIA official. Posada had escaped incarceration in Venezuela for his role in killing 73 people in a Cuban passenger jet bombing in 1976. Congress also authorized $100 million to support Central American operations following the repeal of the Boland Amendment, a move instigated by Cheney. On October 5th, the operation began to come unglued. That day, a young Nicaraguan soldier brought down the C-123 cargo plane, carrying weapons to the Contras. Former Marine Eugene Hassenfuss, the plane's only survivor, confessed to his Sandinista captors that he worked for the CIA and was supplying the Contras. On election day, November 4th, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Ali Akbar Hashimi Rafsanjani, went public with the story of U.S.-Iranian dealings. Bush, the following day, recorded in his diary, "This is one operation that had been held very, very tight, and I hope it will not leak." It was much too late for that. Details of the murky, convoluted operation were splashed across the nation's newspapers and television screens. The White House issued clumsy denials. On November 13th, Reagan admitted that small amounts of defensive weapons had been transferred, but that "we did not, repeat, did not, trade weapons or anything else for hostages, nor will we." The lies continued when Casey and Rear Admiral John Poindexter testified before Congress. Several of those involved, including Poindexter, North, and General Richard Secord, began shredding thousands of pages of incriminating documents in their possession. On November 25th, Reagan gave what historian Sean Willens described as the worst performance of his presidency, if not his entire career, when he told the press corps that based on the preliminary findings of Attorney General Edwin Meese, he was not fully informed of the nature of one of the activities undertaken in connection with this initiative. He announced that Poindexter was stepping down as National Security Advisor and that North had been relieved of his duties. "As I've stated previously," he added, I believe our policy goals toward Iran were well-founded. However, the information brought to my attention yesterday convinced me that in one aspect, implementation of that policy was seriously flawed. After reading this brief statement, he turned the session over to Meese and walked off, as reporters kept yelling out questions. 1 week later, Gallup reported that Reagan's approval ratings had plummeted 21 points to 46% in the course of the month. Investigations were conducted, all directly implicating Reagan, but making it apparent that he had little grasp of and less control over what his underlings were up to. The Congressional Investigating Committee concluded, if the president did not know what his national security advisers were doing, he should have. Independent counsel Lawrence Walsh declared, President Reagan created the conditions which made possible the crimes committed by others by his secret deviations from announced national policy as to Iran and hostages, and by his own determination to keep the Contras together, body and soul, despite a statutory ban on Contra aid. Among those convicted of crimes were National Security Advisor Bud McFarlane, after an abortive suicide attempt, his successor, Rear Admiral William Poindexter, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, the mastermind behind the entire operation, and Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams. Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger was indicted but pardoned. CIA Director William Casey died of a brain tumor the day after the congressional hearings began. Vice President George H.W. Bush, though having figured prominently in the foolhardy scheme, managed to avoid prosecution. Deputy CIA Director Robert Gates would barely escape prosecution, though the manipulation and politicalization of intelligence on his watch paved the way for Reagan's disastrous policies. McFarlane later regretted not having had the guts to warn Reagan. To tell you the truth, he said, probably the reason I didn't is because if I had done that, Bill Casey, Gene Kirkpatrick, and Cap Weinberger would have said I was some kind of commie. This sordid affair dashed hopes for renewing talks on nuclear disarmament. Gorbachev decided to salvage something by decoupling the intermediate-range ballistic missile issue from other long-term measures. He visited Washington in December 1987 and signed the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, a major milestone in U.S.-Soviet relations. This was the first agreement in history on the mutually agreed destruction of an entire class of nuclear weapons, Gorbachev noted. Meanwhile, Soviet operations were finally winding down in Afghanistan. Reagan and Casey had transformed Carter's tentative support for the Afghan insurgents into the CIA's largest covert operation to date, totaling more than $3 billion. The CIA channeled aid through Pakistan's President Zia, who funneled U.S. arms and dollars to the most extreme Afghan Islamist faction under Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a man of legendary cruelty. According to James Forrest, director of terrorism studies at West Point, Hekmatyar was known to patrol the bazaars of Kabul with vials of acid, which he would throw in the face of any woman who dared to walk outdoors without a full burqa covering her face. He was also known for skinning prisoners alive. Senior State Department official Stephen Cohn admitted,
"The people we did support were the nastier, more fanatic types of Mujahideen."
The CIA station chief in Islamabad, Pakistan, Howard Hart, recalled, "I was the first chief of station ever sent abroad with this wonderful order. Go kill Soviet soldiers. Imagine. I loved it." The CIA even provided between 2,000 and 2,500 USA-made Stinger missiles, some of which WikiLeaks revealed were used to down NATO helicopters 3 decades later. From his early days in office, Gorbachev had made clear his intention to withdraw Soviet troops from Afghanistan and sought U.S. assistance in making that happen. He assured Reagan that his country had no plan for using Afghanistan to gain access to a warm water port, to extend its influence to the Persian Gulf, or to impinge on U.S. interests in any way. The United States worked with the Saudis and Pakistanis to tie Soviet forces down as long as possible, and did what it could to make sure that UN efforts to broker a settlement failed, funneling massive amounts of money and arms to the insurgents, who were also profiting immensely off the suddenly burgeoning opium production and sales. The Chinese, British, and Egyptians contributed millions of dollars worth of weapons. The CIA delivered the money and weapons to Pakistani intelligence. After taking their cut, the Pakistanis shipped the remainder to Afghan rebel leaders in Peshawar, who skimmed off their share before shipping the rest onto the front lines. Many of the stockpiled weapons would later be turned against the United States. Because of the fighting, approximately 3 million Afghans, one-third of the population, fled to Pakistan. In February 1988, Gorbachev announced that Soviet troops would withdraw from the country. The withdrawal began on May 15th and lasted for 10 months. The Geneva Accords ending the fighting were signed by the United States, the Soviet Union, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Only the Soviets adhered to their commitments. Zia promised Reagan that Pakistani supplies to the Afghan rebels would continue to flow unabated. "We'll just lie about it," he said. "That's what we've been doing for 8 years. Muslims have the right to lie in a good cause." Over 1 million Afghans were killed in the fighting. The Pakistani dictatorship profited, becoming the third largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. The United States turned a blind eye toward Pakistan's progress in developing a nuclear bomb. Tens of thousands of Arabs flooded into Pakistan to join the jihad against the infidels, including a wealthy Saudi named Osama bin Laden and Egyptian doctor Ayman al-Zawahiri. They and thousands of other future Islamist terrorists received military training in the Pakistani camps, learning such valuable skills as how to perform assassinations and detonate car bombs. Thousands more flocked to Pakistan's madrasas, where they were indoctrinated in radical Islam and recruited for jihad. The madrasas were one product of the $75 billion the Saudis spent during the 1980s to spread Wahhabi extremism. Casey ignored repeated warnings that the religious fanaticism he was helping unleash would eventually pose a threat to U.S. interests. He instead persisted in his view that the unholy partnership between Christianity and Islam would endure and could be used to bludgeon the Soviets throughout the region. In fact, in mid-decade, Casey unleashed Mujahideen raids across the border into the Soviet Union in the hope of inciting Islamist uprisings by Soviet Muslims. Upon withdrawing from Afghanistan, the Soviets sounded out U.S. willingness to collaborate on curbing Islamic extremism in Afghanistan. But the Americans could not be bothered. The diehard Islamists, now in control of Afghanistan, worked closely with Pakistani intelligence. Having achieved its goals, the United States washed its hands of the mess it had helped create. Former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Charles Freeman, complained, "We start wars without figuring out how we would end them. Afghanistan was lurching into civil war and we basically didn't care anymore." He said that he and U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan, Robert Oakley, had tried to get CIA officials, from directors Robert Gates and William Webster on down, to think seriously about ending the U.S., Saudi, and Pakistani involvement. But they were dealing with people who reasoned, "Why should we go out there and talk to people with towels on their heads?" According to RAND expert Cheryl Bernard, whose husband Zalmay Khalilzad served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, "We made a deliberate choice. At first, everyone thought, there's no way to beat the Soviets. So what we have to do is throw the worst crazies against them that we can find. And there was a lot of collateral damage. We knew exactly who these people were and what their organizations were like. And we didn't care. Then we allowed them to just kill all the moderate leaders. The reason we don't have moderate leaders in Afghanistan today is because we let the nuts kill them all. They killed the leftists, the moderates, the middle-of-the-roaders. They were just eliminated during the 1980s and afterwards." Reagan left office a befuddled old man, who claimed little knowledge of things going on under his nose. Yet many people lionize him and credit him with having restored the United States' faith in itself after the failed presidencies of Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Carter. Even before Reagan's second term, conservatives had begun anointing him one of the nation's great presidents. A 1984 Republican campaign memo read, "Paint Reagan as the personification of all that is right with or heroized by America. Leave Mondale in a position where an attack on Reagan is tantamount to an attack on America's idealized image of itself." But what is Reagan's real legacy? One of the most poorly informed and least engaged chief executives in U.S. history, he empowered a right-wing resurgence of hardline anti-communists who militarized U.S. foreign policy and rekindled the Cold War. He paid lip service to democracy while arming and supporting repressive dictators. He turned local and regional conflicts in the Middle East and Latin America into Cold War battlegrounds, unleashing a reign of terror to suppress popular movements. He spent enormous sums on the military while cutting social programs for the poor. He sharply reduced taxes on the wealthy, tripling the national debt and transforming the United States from the world's leading creditor in 1981 to its biggest debtor by 1985. In October 1987, he oversaw the worst stock market collapse since the Great Depression. He let the chance to rid the world of offensive nuclear weapons slip through his fingers because he wouldn't let go of a childish fantasy. And as for his much-vaunted role in ending the Cold War, as we will see, the lion's share of credit goes instead to his Soviet counterpart, Mikhail Gorbachev. Chapter 12. The Cold War Ends. Squandered Opportunities. Suddenly, a season of peace seems to be warming the world, the New York Times exulted on the last day of July, 1988. Protracted bloody wars were ending in Afghanistan, Angola, Cambodia, and Nicaragua, and between Iran and Iraq. Later that year, Palestinian Liberation Organization leader Yasser Arafat, under pressure from Moscow, renounced terrorism and implicitly recognized Israel's right to exist. But the most dramatic development was still to come. In December 1988, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev declared the Cold War over. "The use or threat of force no longer can be an instrument of foreign policy. This applies above all to nuclear arms. Let me turn to the main issue, disarmament, without which none of the problems of the coming century can be solved. The Soviet Union has taken a decision to reduce its armed forces by 500,000 men. We have decided to withdraw by 1991 six tank divisions from East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary, and to disband them. Soviet forces stationed in those countries will be reduced by 50,000 men, and their armaments by 5,000 tanks. All Soviet divisions remaining will become clearly defensive." He promised to reveal Soviet plans for the transition from the economy of armaments to an economy of disarmament, and called upon other military powers to do likewise through the United Nations. He proposed a 50% reduction in offensive strategic arms, asked for joint action to eliminate the threat to the world's environment, urged banning weapons in outer space, and demanded an end to exploitation of the Third World, including a moratorium of up to 100 years on debt servicing by the least developed countries. Still, he was not finished. He called for a UN-brokered ceasefire in Afghanistan as of January 1st. In 9 years of war, the Soviets had failed to defeat the Afghan insurgents, despite deploying 100,000 troops, working closely with local Afghans, and building up the Afghan army and police. He proposed an international conference on Afghan neutrality and demilitarization, and held out an olive branch to the incoming administration of George H.W. Bush, offering a joint effort to put an end to an era of wars, confrontation, and regional conflicts, to aggressions against nature, to the terror of hunger and poverty, as well as to political terrorism. This is our common goal, and we can only reach it together. The New York Times characterized Gorbachev's riveting hour-long speech as the greatest act of statesmanship since Wilson's 14 points in 1918, or Roosevelt and Churchill's Atlantic Charter in 1941. The basic restructuring of international politics. And, the Times proclaimed, he promised to lead the way unilaterally. Breathtaking. Risky. Bold. Naive. Diversionary, heroic. His ideas merit, indeed compel, the most serious response from President-elect Bush and other leaders. The Washington Post called it a speech as remarkable as any ever delivered at the United Nations. Bush had not yet moved into the White House after trouncing Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis in the recent election. Trailing by 17 points during the summer, Bush struggled to overcome what was widely being described as the wimp factor. For a while, it looked like the election might turn on the issue of whether Bush was too much of a wimp to be president. Some thought it odd that Bush, a recipient of a Distinguished Flying Cross, who had flown 58 combat missions in the Pacific during World War II, would be so derided. Newsweek considered it a potentially crippling handicap. A perception that he isn't strong enough or tough enough for the challenges of the Oval Office. Not even the fact that Bush captained Yale's baseball team earned him a pass. The Washington Post's Kurt Supley wrote, "Wimp, wasp, weenie, every woman's first husband, bland conformist." These now shop-worn pejoratives are the essence of George Bush's image problem. The vague but powerful suspicion of many citizens that the vice president may be too feckless and insubstantial to be the leader of the free world. He's been reduced to a cartoon, his second son, Jeb Bush, complained. Commentators attributed the image to his wealthy, pampered upbringing and his Ivy League education. Always staid and reserved, he had been nicknamed Poppy as a boy. Despite resigning from the Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission, he couldn't shake the image of being the ultimate establishment candidate, the man endorsed by David Rockefeller. On top of that, most of his political offices had been appointments. None of Reagan's charisma had rubbed off on him as Reagan's vice president. It turned out that Reagan didn't like Bush and hadn't wanted him on the ticket, but his preferred choices, Senator Paul Laxalt and Representative Jack Kemp, wouldn't fly. Bush's kowtowing to Reagan and the right-wing policies he had previously opposed, including what he called voodoo economics, made him look weak and unprincipled. "I'm following Mr. Reagan blindly," Bush told one reporter upon receiving the nomination. He went so far as to call Oliver North, a man he would have once found contemptible, his hero. One commentator noted that Bush tried on the boorish philosophies of the political right to get closer to the Oval Office. Bush's initial victory in the New Hampshire primary frustrated his principal opponent, Bob Dole, who fumed, "There's nothing there." People thought he lacked a home or community. He officially resided in a Houston hotel and derided his tendency to end sentences with muddy phrases like "whatever it is" and all that sort of stuff, and mocked his speech disturbances, sentence incompletion, interruption of word sequences, and tongue slips. Feisty Texas Governor Ann Richards quipped at the Democratic National Convention, "Poor George. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth." When parading his war record, defending gun rights, frequenting barbecues and shamelessly pandering to the right did nothing to help Bush change his image. He tried a different strategy. He questioned Dukakis's patriotism and openly played the race card with a campaign ad about furloughed murderer Willie Horton that appealed to voters' fear of crime. But the coup de grace came when CBS News anchor Dan Rather pressed him on his involvement in the Iran-Contra scandal. Bush was ready to pounce. He challenged the question's fairness and angrily retorted, "It's not fair to judge my whole career by a rehash on Iran. How would you like it if I judged your career by those 7 minutes when you walked off the set in New York?" His strategy worked. Reporters referred to the Rather bushwhacking, calling Bush a bully. Few noticed that Rather's questions about Bush's role were entirely legitimate. During the campaign, Bush insisted that he had been out of the loop, no operational role, in the illegal operation. But in his taped diary, the former CIA director admitted, "I'm one of the few people that know fully the details." Bush would later pardon former Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger to avoid testimony about Bush's role in the scandal. Bush's foreign policy team included James A. Baker III at State, Dick Cheney at Defense, and General Brent Scowcroft as his national security advisor. Scowcroft chose Robert Gates as his number two man. Paul Wolfowitz took over as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. While in New York to address the United Nations, Gorbachev met with Reagan and Bush, seeking help on arms control and troop withdrawal. But Bush's advisors remained skeptical, and the CIA, whose intelligence capabilities had been degraded by years of unrelenting right-wing assault, completely misread what was occurring. As Gates later admitted in his memoirs, the American government, including CIA, had no idea in January 1989 that a tidal wave of history was about to break upon us. Gates and Cheney were most skeptical of Gorbachev's initiatives and sought ways to take advantage of his willingness to reform the Soviet system. For the most part, Cheney's opposition to working with Gorbachev prevailed. Cheney opposed an early summit, fearing that Gorbachev's initiatives would weaken Western resolve. Bush decided on a strategy that would further erode Soviet military strength. Whereas Gorbachev was calling for eliminating tactical nuclear weapons in Europe, an offer most Europeans applauded, the United States countered that the Soviet Union should remove 325,000 troops in exchange for a U.S. cut of 30,000. Bush and Gorbachev did not meet again for another year. While neglecting the Soviet Union, Bush continued to play the China card, building on the economic and political ties that Reagan had forged with Chinese leaders, who had assisted in toppling pro-Soviet governments in Afghanistan and Cambodia. As former ambassador to China, Bush intended to maintain close relations. His plans were almost derailed by Beijing's brutal crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators. As television viewers around the world looked on, the People's Liberation Army slaughtered 3,000 demonstrators in Tiananmen Square, wounding 10,000 more. But Bush resisted pressure to punish China's rulers, initially even opposing legislation allowing the 43,000 Chinese students in the United States to remain in the country beyond their one-year visas. Gorbachev hoped to jumpstart the Soviet economy, which had been moribund since the late 1970s. He knew that the Soviet Union could no longer afford war in Afghanistan, support for Third World allies, and a military establishment that consumed more than 20% of GNP and more than half of total government expenditures. Soviet officials decided to cut their losses. They ended support for Cuban troops in Angola and Ethiopia and Vietnamese troops in Cambodia and pulled Soviet troops out of Afghanistan in early 1989. The Third World, an arena that had looked so promising a decade earlier, was now unraveling. The Soviet people had tired of expensive and ill-advised adventures. The Afghan War had cost the lives of over 14,000 Soviets and hundreds of thousands of Afghans, drained scarce resources, and inflamed anti-communist feeling throughout the Muslim world. Young Muslim radicals who had once turned to socialism now looked to radical Islam. The faltering Soviet economy no longer provided a viable model for development. Fed up with the repressive and costly policies of many of the Soviet Union's Third World allies, who resisted his demands to change their ways, Gorbachev proposed that the United States and the Soviet Union both stop interfering in Third World affairs and let nations settle their disputes amicably. At the Moscow summit in May 1988, Gorbachev had asked Reagan to co-sign a statement affirming peaceful coexistence and disavowing military interventions into other nations' internal affairs. Reagan refused to sign. Undeterred, Gorbachev acted unilaterally. Historian Odd Arne Westad grasped the significance of this extraordinary reversal. Gorbachev and his advisors developed an understanding of the significance of national self-determination that went beyond those of the leaders of any major power in the 20th century. The Soviet president practiced what both liberals and revolutionaries had been calling for at the beginning of the century: a firm and idealist dedication to letting the peoples of the world decide their own fates without foreign intervention. Not only did the United States not accept this principle, it worked actively to subvert it, exploiting the openings Gorbachev had provided in the Third World. The United States continued to fuel Islamic radicalism. Many of the U.S.-backed jihadis who had fought against the Soviets in Afghanistan joined the Islamist cause in Chechnya, Bosnia, Algeria, Iraq, the Philippines, Saudi Arabia, Kashmir, and elsewhere. Ethnic and tribal conflicts also erupted in Africa and the Balkans. Gorbachev urged Eastern European governments to embrace the spirit of perestroika. Poland was the first to act. In April 1989, the government of General Wojciech Jaruzelski agreed to free elections. In June, candidates from the Solidarity Trade Union Federation, with clandestine CIA support, soundly defeated the communists, who peacefully relinquished power, agreeing to participate in a Solidarity-led coalition government. Unlike in Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia in 1968, the Soviets did not intervene. In May, Estonia and Lithuania declared their sovereignty. Latvia followed in July. Gorbachev encouraged the reformers. In late July, Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze explained the Soviet acceptance of these changes to Secretary of State Baker. "If we were to use force, then it would be the end of perestroika. We would have failed. It would be the end of any hope for the future, the end of everything we're trying to do, which is to create a new system based on humane values. If force is used, it will mean that the enemies of perestroika have triumphed. We would be no better than the people who came before us. We cannot go back." Other Eastern European nations followed suit. In October, the ruling communists in Hungary declared themselves social democrats and established a republic. That month, following Gorbachev's visit to Berlin, demonstrators drove Erich Honecker from power in East Germany. And finally, on November 9, 1989, East and West Berliners jointly began tearing down the Berlin Wall, desecrating the Cold War's most reviled symbol. Gorbachev's foreign policy advisor, Anatoly Chernyev, wrote in his diary, "The Berlin Wall has collapsed. This entire era in the history of the socialist system is over. This is the end of Yalta and the Stalinist legacy. This is what Gorbachev has done. He has sensed the pace of history and helped history to find a natural channel." But the transformation of Europe was far from over. The Czech parliament responded to demonstrations and a general strike by electing poet Václav Havel prime minister. One by one, all the Eastern European communist governments fell. The world watched in disbelief. A peaceful revolution had occurred across the socialist bloc as citizens, burdened by decades of government repression and bureaucratic ineptitude, clamored for a better life, Gorbachev rejected the long-held view that controlling Eastern Europe was crucial to Soviet security. He believed that removing the drain of Eastern Europe would allow the Soviet Union and its allies to rapidly develop humane, democratic socialist systems. Gorbachev saw this as a new beginning, but many U.S. policymakers hailed it as the ultimate vindication, the triumph of the capitalist West after decades of Cold War. It was the end of history, State Department policy planner Francis Fukuyama declared, anointing Western liberal democracy the final form of human government. In September 1990, Michael Mandelbaum, director of East-West Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, exulted, "The Soviets have made it possible to end the Cold War, which means that for the first time in 40 years, we can conduct military operations in the Middle East without worrying about triggering World War III." The United States would soon test that hypothesis. When Bush traveled to Poland and Hungary in July, he deliberately avoided saying or doing anything that might provoke a Soviet response. Having previously derided the vision thing, even the tearing down of the Berlin Wall failed to elicit a jubilant response on his part. He explained, "I am not an emotional kind of guy." He told Gorbachev, "I have conducted myself in ways not to complicate your life. That's why I have not jumped up and down on the Berlin Wall." "Yes, we have seen that, and appreciate it," Gorbachev replied. Though willing to allow for the radical transformation of Eastern Europe, Gorbachev hoped the end of the Cold War would lead to the dissolution of NATO, as well as the Warsaw Pact. Recognizing that that might not happen, he insisted that NATO at least not expand farther to the east. He was even willing to allow for reunification of the two Germanies, as long as NATO troops and weapons were not permitted on former East German soil. But he and other Russian leaders who believed they had received ironclad U.S. and German promises that eastward expansion by NATO would never be permitted were in for a rude awakening when the Clinton and second Bush administrations continued expanding right up to Russia's doorstep. Russian leaders expressed outrage and a sense of betrayal. Although U.S. officials over the years have insisted that no such promises were ever given, recently released documents appear to substantiate the Russian claims. In February 1990, Bush, Baker, and German Chancellor Helmut Kohl sought ways to convince Gorbachev to remove the 380,000 Soviet troops in East Germany and renounce legal claims of occupation dating back to Germany's surrender in 1945. They wanted to avoid the growing demand from many of the newly liberated countries to demilitarize Central and Eastern Europe, a move that would have diminished the U.S. domination of Europe. Baker met with Gorbachev on February 9th and asked him, "Would you prefer to see a unified Germany outside of NATO, independent and with no U.S. forces, or would you prefer a unified Germany to be tied to NATO, with assurances that NATO's jurisdiction would not shift one inch eastward from its present position?" Baker recorded Gorbachev's reply that any extension of the zone of NATO would be unacceptable. Helmut Kohl met with Gorbachev the following day and stated that naturally NATO could not expand its territory into East Germany. On February 10th, German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher conveyed the same message to Eduard Shevardnadze, stating, "We are aware that NATO membership for a unified Germany raises complicated questions. For us, however, one thing is certain. NATO will not expand to the east." To make sure that his Soviet counterpart understood that this applied to all of Eastern Europe, and not just Germany, Genscher added, "As far as the non-expansion of NATO is concerned, this also applies in general." Upon receiving Kohl's assurance, Gorbachev approved German reunification. But no legally binding papers were signed. The deal was not in writing. And Gorbachev later compounded the problem by agreeing in September to allow NATO expansion into East Germany in exchange for desperately needed financial assistance from Germany. Clearly, Gorbachev thought there had been an agreement and felt that he had been blindsided. The United States and West Germany had promised not to expand NATO as much as a thumb's width further to the east, he insisted. President Dmitry Medvedev was equally perturbed, contending in 2009 that the Soviet Union had gotten none of the things that we were assured, namely that NATO would not expand endlessly eastwards and our interests would be continuously taken into consideration. U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, Jack Matlock, has agreed that the Soviet Union was given a clear commitment. The German news magazine, Der Spiegel, conducted its own investigation in late 2009, finding that, after speaking with many of those involved and examining previously classified British and German documents in detail, Spiegel has concluded that there was no doubt that the West did everything it could to give the Soviets the impression that NATO membership was out of the question for countries like Poland, Hungary, or Czechoslovakia. Historian Mary Elise Surratt, author of an award-winning book on this period, explained, "In summary, Gorbachev had listened to Baker and Kohl suggest to him for 2 days in a row that NATO's jurisdiction would not move eastward, and at the end he agreed to let Germany unify." The United States, for its part, appreciated Gorbachev's restraint in Eastern Europe, but didn't hesitate to use force in its own backyard. Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega had long been the United States' boy in Central America. He had twice attended the U.S. Army School of the Americas in the Panama Canal Zone, and had been on the CIA payroll since the 1960s. Corrupt and unscrupulous, he profited from assisting Colombia's Medellin drug cartel, but he also fingered Medellin rivals to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. His assistance to the Contras in Nicaragua won him protection from top Reagan administration officials, including William Casey, Elliot Abrams, and Oliver North. But his 1988 indictment on U.S. federal drug charges and his overturning of Panama's 1989 presidential election finally convinced Bush that he was more of a liability than an asset. With U.S. encouragement, Panamanian military officers attempted a coup. The United States, however, offered no assistance. The chair of the House Select Committee on Intelligence, David McCurdy, bemoaned the resurgence of the wimp factor. In December 1989, Bush decided to act unilaterally and bypass Congress in violation of the War Powers Act of 1973. He sent 15,000 troops to assist the 12,000 already in the country to overthrow Noriega and take down his Panamanian defense forces and paramilitary units in what the United States called Operation Just Cause. Bush attempted to defend the invasion, claiming that he had acted only after reaching the conclusion that every other avenue was closed and the lives of American citizens were in grave danger. One reporter pushed Cheney for an explanation. "Mr. Secretary, following the failed coup in Panama, you came into this room and you made a number of arguments justifying our decision not to get more heavily involved. You said it wasn't up to the United States to go willy-nilly around the world knocking off governments. Why is your earlier assessment, which you made in this room 2 months ago, not valid anymore?" Cheney responded, apparently with a straight face, "I think we as a government bent over backward to avoid having to take military action, only invading when it became clear that American lives were at risk." Latin Americans angrily condemned the return to gunboat diplomacy. Mexico proclaimed that fighting international crimes is no excuse for intervention in a sovereign nation. Cuba denounced the new imperialist aggression and said it showed the disdain of the United States for international law. The Organization of American States voted 20-1 to deeply deplore the invasion. Only a U.S. veto blocked similar U.N. Security Council action. Latin Americans' bitterness about the invasion, which violated the charter of the OAS, would persist for years. Shortly after the 9/11 attacks by Al-Qaeda, the editors of the Nicaragua-based magazine Envio wrote that in December 1989, the government of George Bush Sr. ordered the invasion of Panama, a military operation that bombed civilian neighborhoods and killed thousands of Panamanians just to flush out a single man, Manuel Noriega. Was that not state terrorism? They asked. Soviet U.S. expert Georgi Arbatov warned that the invasion would strengthen Soviet hardliners, who would see through the hypocrisy of the United States praising Soviet non-intervention while it was itself overthrowing governments. They had good reason to feel that way. The invasion was indeed a signal that Soviet inaction would not curb U.S. bellicosity. It might, in fact, embolden the United States to act more recklessly. The Washington Post's Bob Woodward pointed to Colin Powell's support for the invasion as critical to Bush's decision-making. Powell declared, "We have to put a shingle outside our door saying, 'Superpower lives here,' no matter what the Soviets do, even if they evacuate from Eastern Europe." Neocon Elliot Abrams concluded that the United States should have invaded sooner and speculated that the reduced danger of escalation makes limited military action more rather than less likely. Noriega eluded U.S. forces for almost a week before seeking asylum at the Vatican embassy. The United States surrounded the embassy with enormous speakers and, despite Vatican protests, blasted rock music. Songs like "I Fought the Law and the Law Won," "Nowhere to Run," and "You're No Good," "Around the Clock." Noriega was sentenced to jail in the United States for drug trafficking. In the aftermath of the seemingly successful and popular military action, the supine Congress failed to challenge the president for flouting the War Powers Act, which requires the White House to seek congressional approval for the use of force in other countries. But Bush wasn't finished. The Reagan administration had cozied up to Iraq's Saddam Hussein, removing Iraq from the State Department list of terrorist states and backing it in its war against Iran. Even Saddam's use of chemical weapons to crush Kurdish resistance had elicited little protest. Following a clumsy attempt by the United States to pin that crime on Iran, Bush extended an additional $1.2 billion in credits and loans to Saddam, while Kuwait demanded that Iraq repay the money it had borrowed to wage war against Iran. Kuwait also refused to abide by the OPEC oil quotas, driving down the price of oil at a time when Iraq desperately needed the revenue to repay over $40 billion in accrued debts. Further angering Saddam, Kuwait, which had been part of Iraq until 1961, rejected Iraq's claims on their disputed border. U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie met with Saddam in Baghdad on July 25, 1990, assuring him that Bush wanted better and deeper relations and had no opinion on its border dispute with Kuwait, which had been no friend of the United States. Senator and former U.N. Ambassador Daniel Patrick Moynihan described Kuwait to fellow senators as a particularly poisonous enemy of the United States, whose anti-Semitism was at the level of the personally loathsome. Saddam took Glaspie's remarks as a signal that the United States would acquiesce in his Kuwaiti takeover. The following week, three Iraqi divisions entered Kuwait, giving Iraq control of one-fifth of the world's oil supply. In September, Glaspie effectively confirmed that she had led Saddam on, telling the New York Times, "I didn't think, and nobody else did, that the Iraqis were going to take all of Kuwait." Cheney, Powell, and General Norman Schwarzkopf rushed to meet with Saudi Arabia's King Fahd. They showed him doctored photos of 150,000 Iraqi troops and 1,500 tanks poised just across his border in Kuwait, and convinced him to allow a large U.S. military force onto Saudi soil, giving the United States its long-sought toehold in the region. The deception was soon exposed. A Japanese newspaper obtained satellite photos showing no Iraqi troop buildup in the area. American media took interest in the story. ABC News purchased additional satellite photos the following month, reconfirming the original assessment. Newsweek called it the case of the missing military presence. In fact, Newsweek reported, all they could see, in crystal clear detail, was the U.S. buildup in Saudi Arabia. U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia Charles Freeman warned, this will never work. All it's going to take is one photo of some GI pissing on the wall of a mosque, and the Saudi government will be overthrown. Despite Pentagon pressure to bury the story, Gene Heller, a highly respected reporter with the St. Petersburg Times, decided to pursue it, obtaining more photos that she showed to physicist and defense analyst Peter Zimmerman, who exposed the fraudulence of the U.S. claims. Newsday reported the comments of one senior U.S. commander who acknowledged there was a great disinformation campaign surrounding this war. There is no evidence that Saddam ever intended to invade Saudi Arabia. Powell acknowledged that for the first 3 weeks, Iraq could have marched unimpeded into Saudi Arabia if it had so desired. He agreed with Turkish and Arab leaders that sanctions would force Saddam to reverse course. Former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara urged the Senate to use sanctions, not war. In fact,